A visitor from the stars, this week on Planetary Radio. Welcome, I'm Matt Kaplan of the Planetary Society, with more of the human adventure across our solar system and beyond. It is the first object we've discovered that has definitely come from beyond our solar system. Karen Meach leads the team that discovered and is studying Oumuamua. She'll tell us about this strange asteroid and the tool that allowed us to find it. First, though, Planetary Society CEO Bill Nye has lots he wants to talk about this week. Bill, it's a milestone in space exploration, space technology at least, albeit a small one, but still, turning the key after 37 years and the engine turns over?
I know. So this is the Voyager spacecraft, everybody. Left the Earth. I had just graduated from engineering school in 1977. This thing's been flying in space ever since then.
This set of thrusters has not been used in 37 years, since 1980.
And so then they just send it a command by radio, way the heck, 16 plus hours at light speed out in space, and the thruster's fired. It's just cool.
It really is.
It's cool. It's your tax dollars at work, everybody. It just shows you that space brings out the best in us. And by that, I mean there was somebody in management who hired the right people to specify the right specifications. And people, skilled technicians, built these thrusters, mounted them on, and the chain of custody of every rivet and screw and wire and solder joint was managed well enough so that the thing works almost 40 years later.
Amazing. Speaking of turning the key, he said in another clever segue, Elon Musk has his interesting payload plans.
So everybody, we at the Planetary Society are very much looking forward to the launch of the Falcon Heavy rocket. The Falcon Heavy is SpaceX's rocket that is three Falcon 9s strapped together. Now, a Falcon 9 has 9 engines, so the first stage of the Falcon Heavy will have 27 engines. It's a very powerful rocket. And what does Mr. Musk want to launch into space? That's right. His first Tesla Roadster car. Now, some of you may or may not remember the Roadster. It was a rocket.
Yeah.
It was a very big electric motor with a whole bunch of batteries and very, very little else. Just 2 seats, and the thing would go very fast. A range of, in U.S. units, 400 miles or something, because the batteries were so big. So he's willing to just shoot the thing into space and let it go while he's playing David Bowie Space Odyssey. No, wait, Space Oddity came out the same year as the movie. He's going to send the thing off into space just to show how much he loves the technology. It really is. It's exciting. So we at the Planetary Society are very much looking forward to the successful launch of the space launch of the Falcon Heavy, my word, the Falcon Heavy, because the LightSail 2 spacecraft will be on board. You know, our LightSail 2 is all set. The batteries are charged up. The clock's running. We're just waiting for the green light. So it's exciting. More power to SpaceX. They are changing the game, man. They are making everybody think about rocketry a little differently, and that is a worthy undertaking.
Absolutely.
Let's change the world.
That's Bill Nye, the CEO of the Planetary Society, who joins us now and then here on Planetary Radio. You asked for it, and I assume you asked for it because you're as excited about our recent interstellar visitor as all of us are at the Planetary Society. The discovery was made as this strange asteroid was already on its way back out of our neighborhood, but not before astronomers around the world, along with the Hubble Space Telescope, were able to examine it. Karen Meach is an astronomer and astrobiologist at the University of Hawaii's Institute for Astronomy. It was one of her colleagues who first realized he had captured an image of something very strange. That was in mid-October. Within a week or two, we knew it had come from far beyond Pluto, the Kuiper Belt, and the Oort cloud. We'd also learned that it is almost certainly shaped like a needle, 10 times as long as it is wide. As it headed back toward the stars, I asked Karen to join me via a not-great Skype connection for a conversation about Oumuamua, how it got that name, and the powerful system that imaged it. Karen, congratulations to you and the team. that has discovered and is now studying this fascinating new object. And thank you for joining us on Planetary Radio.
You're welcome.
Tell us about this visitor from across the galaxy.
Well, it was certainly very exciting when Richard Wainscote called me at home right after I'd gotten back from the Division for Planetary Sciences meeting saying, it looks like this really is interstellar. I said, wow, we're going to have to get on this immediately. Although I had secretly hoped to have a week finally where I had caught up on everything, but it's not to be.
No, so the cosmos didn't cooperate.
No, it did not. And in fact, in the middle of all of this, Richard said, uh-oh, I think we have another one. And I said, please, not now. It turned out that it was just a long period comet, not a hyperbolic orbit. So,
only one of those.
Yes.
Could you talk about how it was discovered and who was the first to notice it?
Well, each day there is a staff member who looks at the imaging data to verify that they really are streaked objects, not artifacts on the CCD. And Rob Warrick happened to be the one observing the data on the morning of the 19th. And he was the one to have discovered it.
A lot of our listeners, maybe most of them, have probably seen at least some of the artist's concepts of this object. It is not a typical looking rock, is it?
No. We were very surprised when we saw the light curve having a brightness range of 2.5 magnitudes. There's just nothing in the solar system that has a range that big. If it's tilted over and there's foreshortening, this thing could actually be longer than 10 to 1. So this is just really bizarre.
You lead what is now an international team of outstanding observers who've been trying to characterize this object. How did all of that come together? Is that just a natural function of people jumping on something fascinating like this?
Yes, and I've had a lot of experience running large observing teams because of my role with the Deep Impact mission, the Epoxy mission. So I was in charge of planet Earth's observations, if you will. So I do have a network of observers. And so the instant we realized this was important, we realized we had to get telescope time. So the first order of business is to write what are called director's discretionary proposals, where you're asking for some of the pot of telescope time that the director has set aside. And typically you ask for a small amount, and typically that's available to the community as soon as the data comes in. So we got data on both 8-meter telescopes in Chile. We requested data from the Hubble Space Telescope and from several facilities on Mauna Kea. We didn't start with Mauna Kea because the weather early in that week was really bad in Hawaii.
So that included the Keck telescopes, or at least one of them on Mauna Kea?
Well, the Keck telescope does not have director's time available at all. Luckily, one of the Pan-STARRS staff actually was planning to observe that week, and so he donated some of his time.
Wow. That's a very big donation for somebody to give up some of their time, right?
Yes, I think he gave up 3 hours out of one night, so that is a lot of time.
Man, he is to be congratulated. Somebody needs to bake that guy a cake. We've learned a fair amount about this object, and we had to do it quickly, right? Because it was on its way out.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this thing was, when it was discovered, it was well past its perihelion on September 9th. Its close Earth approach was October 14th, and it was probably its brightest around the 16th or so of October. And then after that, it was fading by about 0.4 of a magnitude a day at first. So effectively, we had around 2 weeks when you could do a good job of trying to characterize it. We can still observe it now, but it's exceedingly difficult, and you're not going to be doing the main characterization that we've done early on in October.
This shape is so atypical compared to our local neighborhood asteroids. Has there been speculation already about how it might have formed?
Well, there's lots of speculation about everything, whether or not it's realistic yet. I think this will be one area that people will focus on scientifically once the frenzy has died down of trying to get the last bit of data. You know, there has been speculation, maybe some process that ejected it from its solar system somehow affected its shape. And if you imagine that that's just collisions, we would wonder why we wouldn't have things that shape in our solar system. Others have speculated maybe there was a supernova explosion which ejected material from a young star system, and that could have stripped off some of the outer layers. So there's all sorts of ideas floating around, and it will be very interesting to see which ones play out scientifically.
Speaking of extraordinary claims, if you'll go with me for just a few moments into this sort of far end, the deep end of the internet, there are, of course, those who are immediately claiming that this is an artificial object, shall we say, and that this is proof of Lord knows how many other crackpot theories that are out there. Extraordinary claims, right?
Yeah, you know, I guess we can't prove it's not something artificial, but if you really are going to go that route, you better be absolutely certain. And everything that we see suggests that this is of natural origin. The trajectory looks like it's simply controlled by the sun's gravity as it went around the sun, sort of a gravitational slingshot effect. The size is typical of, you know, small solar system fragments, relics of the formation. The color is similar to solar system objects. It's rotating with a period of around 7 hours, which is typical of things in our solar system. You know, that lends you to believe it really is natural. On the other hand, the spectrum is also consistent with nickel iron metal. The shape, as people have noted, is very interesting from the science fiction point of view. But those are very weak associations with the extraordinary explanation. So I think you have to go with the natural.
That's fine, but now expect another call from me next week if this thing suddenly changes course.
Now that probably would be definitive evidence of something unusual.
When we return, I'll ask Karen Meach about chasing Oumuamua, the first interstellar asteroid. This is Planetary Radio.
Hi, this is Casey Dreyer, the Director of Space Policy here at the Planetary Society. And I wanted to let you know that right now Congress is debating the future of NASA's budget. The House has proposed to increase NASA's budget and also increase planetary science in 2018. The Senate, however, has proposed to cut both. You can make your voice heard right now. We've made it easy to learn more if you go to planetary.org/petition2017. Thank you.
You can share your passion for space exploration by giving someone a gift membership to the Planetary Society this holiday season or any time of year. Your friend or loved one would join us as we nurture new and exciting science, advocate for space, and educate the world. The gift of space starts at planetary.org/give space. That's planetary.org/give space. Because, come on, it's space.
Welcome back to Planetary Radio. I'm Matt Kaplan. University of Hawaii astronomer and astrobiologist Karen Meach heads the global team that continues to study and wonder at Oumuamua, the first confirmed interstellar object to enter our solar system. We're going to talk about how it got that name, but also ahead is a conversation about the instrument that enabled its discovery. You can hear much more of my conversation with Karen in the podcast version of this week's show at planetary.org/radio. You mentioned your involvement with that great mission, Deep Impact, that smacked into Temple 1, Comet Temple 1, back in 2005. How much would you love to see a spacecraft chase this thing down, as has actually been suggested by some people at Caltech, that one of Elon Musk's drawing board BFR rockets could do that? I mean, would you like to get a close-up look?
Oh, sure. I think it's certainly within technological possibility that we could do this. There's one big problem, though, that you would be catching up to it so far from the sun that, you know, most missions have at their end state some optical navigation to make sure that they're homing in on the object. Reaching this object between 1 to 200 astronomical units from the sun, it would be so dark that I think it would be very difficult to do that final end stage navigation. I think a better idea would be to have a spacecraft built and waiting for the next one that comes along. And hopefully the next one could be on its inbound trajectory, so you have a chance to actually meet it instead of chasing it.
Do you have any doubt that this object has many, many brothers and sisters out there, some of which have to be headed in toward our solar system?
No, I don't. I think this is the tip of the iceberg, and especially once the Large Synoptic Survey Telescope comes online in Chile in 2022. I think there's going to be a lot of these things discovered. We had the opportunity to look at a piece of another solar system that entered our solar system for a brief period, and I think that's what's really neat about this.
The naming and classification of this object, that's a great story in itself. It's almost as if the International Astronomical Union, not typically noted for moving quickly, moved just about as fast as this asteroid and came up with an entirely new classification. Could you talk about the progression it went through?
Well, you know, of course, the team first had a designation that was hard to remember and hard to type. And then it erroneously got a designation of C/2017U1. And that was just a mistake.
So meaning that they thought it was a comet at that moment. It was a mistake.
Right. It was purely a mistake. Nobody had reported a comet tail.
Wow.
So that was just a mistake. And then that got fixed. And so it got a strange name of A/2017U1, which was not the normal nomenclature. And then we decided we really needed to give it a name. And of course, we'd been shortening it to U1 internally because that was easier to type. And at that point, we said it's got to have a Hawaiian name since it was discovered in Hawaii in honor of the facilities here. And so we requested some input from the director of the Imaloa Center, the visitor center on the Big Island, and from a Hawaiian linguist. And we gave them only 2 days to come up with something because we wanted to have it submitted at the time we submitted the paper. And they delivered a name within a couple of days. They thought about this being a visitor from the distant past coming to the solar system for the first time. And so they, you know, this isn't a name that already existed. The pieces of the name existed as Hawaiian words. And so they put this together as a suggestion for the name, and we liked it.
And then this designation given to it by the IAU of 1I, the very first interstellar object of its kind. I mean, that's got to make people there and elsewhere on this team feel pretty good.
Yes, it does.
I want to get to the system, Pan-STARRS, that enabled this discovery. And before I do that, I have a quote for you, a little surprise. Knowing that we were going to be talking this morning, I wrote to Lindley Johnson, who is the Planetary Defense Officer, as you know, at NASA headquarters, sort of in charge of finding and doing something about near-Earth objects. I asked him for his comment, and he came back with this. We are fortunate that our Pan-STARRS Near-Earth Object Survey Project was able to capture this historic object as it passed so quickly through our corner of the galaxy. This serendipitous discovery is bonus science enabled by NASA's efforts to find, track, and characterize near-Earth objects that could potentially pose a threat to our planet. And Pan-STARRS is a leader in this effort. So congratulations from Lindley as well.
Oh, thank you.
Tell us about Pan-STARRS. I will save you the trouble of spelling out the acronym. It's the Panoramic Survey Telescope and Rapid Response System. From a table that I saw, it looks like even though it only began to observe in 2010, already in 2016, it was discovering, it looked like, nearly half of the near-Earth asteroids that are being discovered each year. And roughly, we should give credit to the Catalina Sky Survey as well, which was doing just about as well.
From my perspective, studying distant comets in particular, it has been phenomenal. It is doing an exceptional job at finding faint things that have just a little bit of cometary activity, as well as an exceptional job at finding fast-moving faint things. So I think it's getting better each year, and I think we're going to be rewarded with lots of interesting discoveries.
Physically, it's a couple of very special telescopes on a mountain.
Physically, it's on the island of Maui on the mountain of Haleakala. Right now, Pan-STARRS 1 is operating. Pan-STARRS 2 is in its commissioning phase, and I believe it will start its main survey observations in February of next year.
It has a very impressive camera. I have something in the gigapixel range, right?
Yeah, this camera is huge, and so that gives it the ability to cover large fractions of the sky each night in order to survey the whole sky. I don't remember how many times each year, but at least half a dozen times each year.
Karen, thank you very much, and best of luck as this multifaceted work continues from there at the University of Hawaii.
Thank you very much.
Karen Meach is an astronomer and astrobiologist at the University of Hawaii's Institute for Astronomy. She's interested, as you've heard, in understanding how the ingredients that make a world habitable are delivered to terrestrial planets in their stars' habitable zone. She leads the University of Hawaii's National Astrobiology Institute research team, where she's particularly interested in how so much water made its way to our own terrestrial planet. And she's a recipient of, this is just a couple of her awards, the Annie Jump Cannon Award in 1988, and much more recently, the University of Hawaii's Regents Medal for Research Excellence. That was in 2015. Time now to talk to another astronomer, the one we talk to every week on the show. That's Bruce Betts. Time for What's Up on Planetary Radio. Bruce Betts is the Director of Science and Technology for the Planetary Society. He's back once again with all of the great stuff that he brings us every week, including a look at the night sky, which is how we'll get started, I'm sure. Welcome once again.
Hi, Matt.
We got a lot of lovely messages in response to your invitation to people to extend their congratulations for our 15-year anniversary. They came in by Twitter. They came in by email. And we are grateful for all of them. Thank you, folks.
Yes, thank you all for doing that. All right, you ready, night sky?
Why not?
Pre-dawn is where it's happening these days. Pre-dawn, we've got Mars, reddish Mars near bluish Spica, but Mars is moving away from Spica and closer to Jupiter, and it's just going to be cool because you're going to have in the pre-dawn east, if you go from lowest to highest, bright Jupiter, reddish Mars, and then bluish Spica. And if you look on the morning of the 13th of December, you will see the crescent moon with it.
If I was Mars, I would move away from Spica and toward Jupiter as well, since I have read that Jupiter protects all of us in the inner solar system.
Okay. Okay, go ahead. We move on quickly to This Week in Space History. It was 1972 that Apollo 17, the last human mission to the moon, launched and landed on the moon.
That's wonderful and sad at the same time.
Speaking of wonderful and sad, let's move on to Random Space Fact. It's nothing to do with the fact. So it's going to be a little less random for a little bit here because you've asked for more. So I've come up with more what things have happened in space since Planetary Radio began 15 years ago. Well, there's so much I'm going to have to carve it up into bits. We had the first Saturn orbiter, Cassini, of course, which you've covered so magnificently. You've covered all these magnificently. Huygens. With Cassini, the first outer planet moon probe and lander, New Horizons, the first Pluto flyby and Pluto system, and Juno, the first solar-powered outer planet's orbiter, all of them got to their destinations doing their things since Planetary Radio started.
I'm impressed.
And once again, it's all due to you, Matt.
We established that pretty well, and there have been a couple of people on Twitter who thanked us for advancing planetary science.
Part of what we do. All right, we move on to the trivia contest. And I asked you, who first proposed the theoretical existence of neutron stars? How'd we do?
Got a very nice response, as usual, for this one. And I think a first-time winner. Alexander Thompson in Ann Arbor, Michigan. Now, he's at least half right, I think. Tell me if you'll accept this. He says that the discoverer, or at least the guy, one of the two people who first theorized that neutron stars were possible, was, as Alexander puts it, crazy old Fritz Zwicky.
I didn't know him personally. I can't comment as to his mental state. He was one of the two people who proposed it.
You want to accept that?
Do you want me to?
Yeah, I think we ought to.
All right, but it's on Matt's head.
like my hat. Alexander, congratulations, therefore, or Alex. A great show, he says. Really appreciate you guys doing this. Alex is going to receive a Chop Shop Design Planetary Society t-shirt and a 200-point iTelescope.net astronomy account. We heard from a bunch of people, including Devin Kremelbein and Joe Murray. They came up with both names. You didn't give the other name of the other guy. Walter, is it Walter Bod?
Manny.
Yeah, Bod or
I'm Manny. Sorry. I'm like, sorry to he and his family and his descendants. I have no idea how to pronounce it.
Well, Devin and Joe were among those who also brought up the fact that they hypothesized the existence of neutron stars only a year after the neutron itself was discovered by James Chadwick.
Yes, it's pretty impressive.
Yeah.
Part of why I wanted to call them out on the show, because it's like, wow, that was quite the leap that turned out to be valid.
Finally, from our poet laureate, Dave Fairchild. Twinkle, twinkle, neutron star, Zwicky knows just what you are. Walter Bod said with pride, man, get too close to that sucker and you're going to be spaghettified. That's it. It ends there. All right. We're ready to go on.
All right. How many spacecraft have either flown by or orbited Jupiter? How many spacecraft have either flown by or orbited Jupiter? Go to planetary.org/radio contest.
You have until the 13th. That's Wednesday, December 13th at 8 a.m. Pacific time to get us the answer. And if you have the right answer and are chosen by random.org, you will get a 200-point iTelescope.net account that will allow you to do astronomy all over the world on that worldwide nonprofit network of telescopes. By the way, we had someone who donated her 200-point account to a school, to a local school that had an astronomy club, and iTelescope was just fine with that. So if you can't use it yourself, there may be somebody around you in your community who would be interested. But wait, there's more. Chop Shop, those great folks that make the Planetary Radio t-shirt and the Planetary Society t-shirt and all kinds of other great wearable and hangable art, they have a new series of posters for kids. It's from their Robots in Space series, but these are really, they're really fun. And there's one for Voyager, one for Cassini, one for the Mars Rovers. And you can win one. We'll give it up. We'll give you the choice of which one you want. You can check them out, of course, at chopshopstore.com. They're in the Planetary Society store at the Chop Shop website.
Glowing in the dark is involved, I just want to say.
That's right. And they're really cool, too. If you look on the website, you'll see them in daylight and in the dark. And they are cool both ways. Thank you, Chop Shop, for making that available.
All right, everybody, go out there, look up the night sky, and think about what highlights there have been in your life in the last 15 years since the creation of Planetary Radio, and how many of those you can blame Matt for. I mean, you know what I mean. Thank you, and good night.
Highlights in my life? That was Highlights Magazine, which was the only good thing about going to see the doctor.
And that's the doctors you see in the last 15 years?
I really like my pediatrician. He's Bruce Betts. He's the Director of Science and Technology for the Planetary Society, who joins us here incredibly every week for What's Up. WFIRST is the Wide Field Infrared Survey Telescope, not Space Telescope, as Bill Nye said last week. I wish I could blame the science guy, but it was all my fault. Don't tell him I steered him wrong. Planetary Radio is produced by the Planetary Society in Pasadena, California, and is made possible by its hyperbolic members. Daniel Gunn is our associate producer. Josh Doyle composed our theme, which was arranged and performed by Peter Schlosser. I'm Matt Kaplan. Clear skies.